This is The Takeaway for Friday, June 3rd, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And here's a question for Friday. Who has the moral high ground in the war on terror? Is it would-be Commander-in-Chief Hillary Clinton, who went after Donald Trump yesterday as someone who she says could not make competent moral judgments as president?
This is not someone who should ever have the nuclear codes, because it's not hard to imagine Donald Trump leading us into a war just because somebody got under his very thin skin.
That's Hillary Clinton in her major foreign policy speech yesterday. Donald Trump has produced excitement and consternation in the world with his style of discourse, the kinds of things he says about foreign affairs, and as a campaigner. And he certainly didn't disappoint yesterday, reacting to Hillary Clinton.
It was so sad to watch. And, you know, she's up there and supposed to be a foreign policy speech. It was a political speech. Had nothing to do with foreign policy. She made a political speech tonight, folks, and it was a pretty pathetic deal.
Does the current president have the moral high ground? He's the winner of a Nobel Peace Prize. He claims he's ending two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's also the man who directs the U.S. secret drone program.
The architecture, the legal architecture around the use of drone strikes or other kinetic strikes wasn't as precise as it should have been, and there's no doubt that civilians were killed that shouldn't have been.
The answer may be none of the above. No one has the moral high ground, and the reason might be the use of those drones, which is a virtual non-issue in the campaign and yet has become a bloody legacy of the Obama administration, and the rising number of civilian deaths, estimated in a range from a few hundred to a few thousand. Last month, 17 Afghans died in successive drone strikes, though both the Afghan and U.S. governments denied any non-combatants were killed. U.S. Army Chaplain Chris Antal served for all of the Obama administration's 8 years. Because of the drones, he decided in April he would resign, declaring he is a conscientious objector.
Currently, these drone wars are a murder weapon, and I believe that they could be used in a more constructive way with proper oversight, with proper checks and balances. But the current policy, yes, these are murder weapons.
Some would say that, well, the use of drones actually reduces casualties. It protects our soldiers. It's a technology that keeps us off of the battlefield. And aside from some mistakes, this is a positive future of warfare.
Yeah, that's a hard argument to sustain, I believe, John. My response to that is blowback. I think that this drone war is creating enemies faster than we can kill them. And decapitation is a poor substitute for strategy. And as a father who has 5 children, I'm concerned 10, 20, 30 years down the road what these current policies are going to bring about for my children and for my grandchildren in this country.
America speaks about the moral high ground in its conduct of war around the world. How is that a difficult argument to make from your perspective?
America likes to make the claim we are one nation under God. We like to make the claim that we are blessed by God. I think that if we're going to make that claim, we need to accept that that means we're one nation, not only under God's grace and protection, but also under God's judgment. And that includes judgment by international law. And when we act in ways that are unaccountable to rules of international law, we are, I think, in good conscience claim we are taking the moral high ground.
For you, what was the turning point in your journey to a place where you could no longer support U.S. policy?
Well, John, I was driven by compassion to volunteer to serve as a chaplain in the Army. I wanted to take care of the wounded, and I was also driven by a sense of responsibility as a citizen. I felt a civic duty to do my fair share in a war effort. What happened for me in Afghanistan was I witnessed drones, and I bore witness to policies and practices that violate deeply held beliefs and values that I carry as both a minister and as a human being.
What was it like to see? What did the drone look like to you? And from the perspective of Afghans who you may have encountered and other soldiers, what kind of feelings did they evoke?
Well, the context of my first encounter with our armed drones was on the flight line at Kandahar Airfield, where as a military chaplain, I was obligated to do my duty to honor our American war dead. There's a ceremony that happens on the flight line called a dignified transfer ceremony, and chaplains support that by our presence there. And it was in the context of that ceremony that I witnessed armed drones and also surveillance drones launching and landing. And they're sleek, they're quiet. And in the context of that service, that solemn memorial service, I was torn in my soul. I wondered if I'm here honoring these American war dead, who is honoring the dead on the other end of these drones?
And the administration would say that the intended dead are militants and military targets, and you would say what?
I would say that we really don't know. The administration has been secret and opaque, and the administration, in my view, needs to stop killing people with drones until we can figure out what is going on.
And is it because the drone has become simply a unilateral murder weapon for the White House, or is it the civilian casualties that have been caused by drones that offends you more?
Well, the latest numbers that the Bureau of Investigative Journalism released just 2 days ago are 7,143 confirmed killed by U.S. drones in just four nations. Most of those are in Pakistan, and that, as a religious leader, I'm appalled, and as a citizen, I'm outraged at the unaccountable killing by our administration.
And do you think, you know, these are mistakes? These are collateral damage is what the administration would say. And there's been plenty of civilian deaths not caused by drones in the course of the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq. How is this different?
Well, there is a moral justification for killing, in my view, and that is to protect the innocent from certain harm. And the real question that America needs to be asking is it necessary to kill these people to protect our homes, our families? And I don't believe it is. I don't believe we meet the criteria of necessity. These are wars of choice, and these are killings of opportunity and convenience, not necessity. And in that sense, he has, I think, stepped beyond his authority as president, elected by a constitutional democratic process. And so the answer is yes.
Reverend Antel is a former U.S. Army chaplain. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John, for having me.
So what does your gut tell you about the moral standing of the United States military right now? We'd love to know. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at takeaway.org. What does the gut of the leading Republican in the Congress tell him about a decision he has to make regarding the 2016 campaign and whether to support the nominee, Donald Trump? Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, told the world yesterday of his decision, of the feelings in his gut, and where he's going to go between now and November. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, tell us about Paul Ryan's summer dance.
Well, Paul Ryan tried to end one of his summer dances yesterday by finally saying he's going to back his party's presumptive nominee. And as you said, John, this has been a dance that's been weeks in the making. Paul Ryan did announce back in Janesville, Wisconsin, his hometown, yesterday that he will vote for Donald Trump. What was unclear was what has actually changed since the time that Paul Ryan said he couldn't yet support Donald Trump and now the time that he says he can. He did write in an editorial that he thinks that Donald Trump will help advance the House conservative agenda, and that's enough for him. So if that's enough for Paul Ryan, it is, but Republicans are still striving for unity. But here's the problem within the universe of the House Republicans, John, which is a whole other dance. We talked last week about that LGBT anti-discrimination amendment that had come up on the House floor. Remember, an amendment passed that said you can't discriminate against LGBT people if you're a federal contractor? Well, that caused a war on the House floor. Some Republicans voted for it until the Republican whip showed up, twisted arms, and defeated that amendment by just one vote. Well, then a couple of days later, it came right back again, that Democratic amendment, on a $60 billion water and energy bill. Democrats put that amendment up. It says you can't discriminate against LGBT people if you're a federal contractor. This time, 43 Republicans voted for it, and it passed. But John, you know what happened the very next day? Republicans then turned on that bill, and because of that LGBT amendment, they voted down the entire $60 billion bill. They killed it. Now, what does that mean? You say, okay, a water bill. Who really cares? No, what this now means is that Democrats now have the votes on any appropriations bill, those spending bills that keep the government running. They now have the ability to put those onto any spending bill that comes up over the summer. And those bills have to pass, or else eventually you get to a government shutdown. Sean Patrick Maloney is from New York. He's the sponsor of the anti-discrimination amendment. And he says, yeah, it keeps coming up.
I mean, it keeps coming up as long as, you know, you can be fired for being who you are or who you love in about two dozen states in this country. So you're darn right it keeps coming up until we get real fairness under equal law.
Procedurally, though, the Democrats will be able to attach this amendment and then, as a result, because of the Republican opposition, defeat all of the appropriations bills, and this becomes leverage?
They get to put it on any appropriations bill. Apparently, they have the votes since 43 Republicans backed it. Now, here's the dance for Paul Ryan. When Paul Ryan rose to the speakership last fall, he did it under the promise of something called regular order. What that basically means is lots of amendments. Everybody can vote. Conservative Republicans demanded this. They didn't want bills to come to the floor that were locked down, where members couldn't put up amendments and vote on them. Well, Democrats say, we're going to put this LGBT anti-discrimination amendment on every bill, put Republicans on the spot. Now Paul Ryan has to decide if he wants to have a war on every bill or he wants to lock the process down, as he promised never to do.
Politics, morality, and opinions about social justice on Capitol Hill, part of the 2016 campaign. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
What do you think about the use of drone warfare and the moral high ground in American military policy?
Louis from Miami. I 100% support President Obama with the drone attacks. This people, we need to attack fire with fire, and he's doing a wonderful job. Casualties or collateral damage is unfortunate, but it is the cost of protecting our country. So keep going and take them away.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. The number of people killed by drone strikes are nearly impossible to quantify. Pakistan has seen the most drone attacks, at least 2,500, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The frequency of attacks in Pakistan has dropped since 2010, but they've become increasingly deadly elsewhere. In March, a drone strike in Somalia killed 150 militants at an al-Shabaab training camp, the largest number of deaths ever recorded in a single attack. And on Wednesday, a drone attack targeted another senior military commander of al-Shabaab in Somalia.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, whose goal is a world without blood cancers, funding research for new treatments and targeted approaches to therapy. Learn more at lls.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
In the dream, they fist their nails into the tender skin of my arm and they pull me east to west. It's like something out of a cartoon. And eventually, they pull so hard and so fast, they divide me in half, right down the middle.
Nice. It's become kind of a tradition on this program, along with the caps and gowns you see this time of year, caps and gowns of graduation, to showcase the winning writers and artists in the annual Scholastic Art and Writing Awards.
In a dream, I become a rice plant, among other rice. And I ask my peers, tell me, once you are cut, How do you grow back? How do you heal yourself?
Since 1923, the awards have honored creative young people before they were historic figures in American culture. Truman Capote, Andy Warhol, Richard Linklater, Sylvia Plath, and Stephen King were all Scholastic winners. Lena Dunham made her parents proud as a Scholastic winner before she became the mogul of millennial sexuality. This year, 16 teenagers from around the country received the top gold medal and a $10,000 scholarship. We heard from two poised and passionate poets, Shyla Grace Kabbalan of Indianapolis and Sylvia Motz of Portland, Oregon.
In the dream, he says, "Fine, I will keep this half." And she says, "I will be back for the other half soon." And she kisses my eye as if to make up for some sacrilege. And then I wake up.
"Listen," they say, "look to your right and left. You'll see more rice. Different versions of you, but essentially the same thing. We urge each other to grow back so that we may all stand tall together in the sun and water."
In the real world, there are no adventures and no waltzes. Only tug of war remains.
Shyla and Grace talked about their passion for writing and the arts. And Shyla told us that she is attracted to the power of writing outside of the episodic blips and monosyllables of social media, they called it. These young people are interested in issues and arguments, and writing, Shyla says, is her voice and her tool.
I tend to not only write fiction, but I also write speeches for my speech team. And my goal throughout these speeches is basically to touch on extremely, like, important issues and to, I don't know, quit this sort of apathy that I feel like young teenagers have become all too accustomed to. So basically, I feel like being able to see writing coming forth from a youth is a lot more influential to young teenagers. I feel like they would feel more compelled to make a difference and change certain problematic aspects of our society through my writing.
Sophia, what's an issue, a particular issue that matters to you and that you use writing to get people motivated in some way?
I think especially in this day and age, with the emergence of technology being so prevalent in our lives and people mainly communicating through social media and texting, it's very easy to feel disconnected from the outside world. So I think it's important for people to commune with the world and to commune with their environment and to not be isolated or try and digitize everything, because that seems like a barrier that we unnecessarily place between ourselves and the world. So my poetry is focused mainly on honoring the natural world and trying to get people to appreciate the small things that the world offers up all around us, but people tend to ignore.
You know, a lot of people, I have three teenage daughters, describe this time as a really empowering, exciting time to be a young woman, because there are so many scary opportunities, so many ways to express yourself. What do you think of this time?
Each day I hear certain things that are said that are not empowering at all. And so it's difficult to kind of balance, like, the vestiges of this kind of patriarchal society that people still have it in their minds that this is the way girls should be. And to also have this legal freedom and this political freedom, which we essentially do have now, and to balance that with the social constructs that are kind of still in place. And there's, you could get into sexual objectification and all of that, but that is a different topic.
Well, how do you resist the messages coming to you from pop culture that, you know, insist upon you taking some stand?
It's so difficult to say, I don't care what anyone thinks, because I do, but I don't want to. But I just focus on what I love, which is poetry and art.
I can see you nodding your head the whole time there, Shyla.
I completely agree 100% with every single thing that you just said, honestly. And I have something to add to that. In our church youth group, we talked about sort of setting like a bar for yourself. And I feel like with the whole problematic issues of human sexuality, particularly female sexuality, I feel like it is very important to be self-aware enough that you understand where you want to go with your own sexuality and not allowing other people to sort of set up a rubric for you. Like, you don't have to be overly sexual, but if you want to be, I mean, just take control of who essentially you want to be and set a standard for yourself. And I don't know, just don't let that waver.
Shyla Grace Kabbalan and Sophia Motz are Scholastic Art and Writing Award winners. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. June 4th is not any kind of a holiday celebrated in China. It is a date everyone knows, but it's also the symbol of a history the government has never fully acknowledged. This song, Nothing to My Name, was the anthem of protesters during the Chinese Tiananmen Square uprising. On June 4th, 1989, it was put down with the whole world watching.
As the world watches and listens in horror, the peaceful pro-democracy demonstration in China comes to a violent and bloody end, crushed by waves of Chinese military forces. Hundreds of unarmed civilians, hungry for freedom, mowed down in Beijing by gun-firing soldiers.
Now everything was turned upside down, and I could not take it.
Watching in the Boston area for student Ha Jin, this moment was the closing of a window, barring him and his family from ever going home again.
I was in a shock, traumatized, because I had been in the Chinese army. It was called the People's Army. You're supposed to protect and serve the people. So that's why I decided to stay in the United States.
His family was able to join him shortly after the Tiananmen Square massacre. But that decision locked this award-winning writer away from the place of his birth and even the language of his childhood. English became a prison, he says, of freedom.
Basically, it was a matter of survival. And on the other hand, also there's a sense of writing in English is another space where I can really have my own voice and speak freely.
Ha Jin found freedom through his fluency in English, but there was a wall separating him from home and his extended family. A wall he has tried many times to get over, only to be blocked by the government in Beijing.
Every time I applied for a visa and got rejected, I would feel sick for a few weeks, just feel despondent, hugely despondent. So I wouldn't try even. You're facing a country that is like a mountain that has no response.
For a writer who experienced the brutal Cultural Revolution as a child, signed up for the army as a 13-year-old, this wall, he says, continues China's suppression of freedom. And there are many other walls, he says. Jin's books are still banned in China, and the government aggressively monitors and controls the internet. And that wall, he says, is beginning to crumble.
Entrepreneurs, the intellectuals, they are smart people. You can't lie to them constantly. I think the current government, they have been dishonest for a long time, and people can see through them. I don't think this kind of restriction can last for long. I don't think it really will work in the long run.
China continues to maintain its official silence on the Tiananmen incident, so-called, and no one has been brought to justice for what happened in Tiananmen's Square of Heavenly Peace. Whatever China's power and leadership becomes economically or militarily in the world, it must still answer for this day, 27 years ago, if it wants to join the community of nations, says Ha Jin.
We have to think about China in comparison with other cultures and societies and political systems. So that's why, for the Chinese, I don't think we should emphasize too much of the difference. It's time for the Chinese people to claim similarity, because they have been mistreated, and in a way they have been exploited.
The takeaway is Corinne Dillon, who has spent more time in China recently than Ha Jin, spoke with the exile, who has become one of America's most decorated living novelists. He's received a National Book Award, 2 Penn Faulkner Awards, and a Pulitzer nomination. But Ha Jin wants most for China to recognize its moral mistakes before it's too late.
A mistake, if that persists, at some point it would become a crime. I think it has become a crime, very clearly.
That's award-winning author Ha Jin speaking to The Takeaway's Corinne Dillon on the 27th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square uprising.
We've been playing in these grungy mung holes waiting for our big break.
The numbers all go to 11.
I am a golden god!
Yeah! Cello.
Okay, this is a bass guitar, and it's the exact same thing, but instead of playing like this, you tip it on the side. Cello.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, joins us every Friday with the movies. You heard some clips from old favorites. Rafe recognizes all of them.
Spinal Tap, School
That's
of
right.
Rock.
That's right. He's the trivia man. This week, though, do we have any candidates for immortality in the movies? Movie number one is Me Before You.
I would say not on that one, but that's a weepy romance with Emilia Clarke and Sam Claflin. She's a working-class British girl who falls in love with an extremely handsome, very wealthy man who is a quadriplegic.
Let's take a little taste of the wedding cake here.
You never would have been looking at these breasts if you hadn't been in a wheelchair.
Of course I would.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. You would have been too busy looking at the leggy blondes, the ones you can smell an expense account at 40 paces. And anyway, I would have been over there serving the drinks.
One of the invisibles. Am I right?
Yes, but in my defense, I was an arse.
Yep.
Do you know something, Clark? You are pretty much the only thing that makes me want to get up in the morning.
Does this work as a relationship?
I'm going to break my answer down into sort of two sections. I think as a standard weepy romance, love story, Fault in Our Stars, right, that kind of thing, it's not bad. And Emilia Clarke is actually really adorable and fun. However, I found that this movie sent a very strangely negative message about the value of life in a wheelchair. And I think that there's already been at least one advocacy group that has come out and called the film to task for this. And it really lands a very sour note to me at the end of this film. This is not the kind of film that I would normally recommend to you, John.
Oh, right. So it's sort of like wants to kill himself by the end or something like that?
I don't want to spoil too much, but I'd be very interested to see what you make of the end of this film, if you can stand it.
They always get it wrong. I won't bother, but thank you. Thanks for the warning.
Yeah, all right.
Movie number two, Pop Star, Never Stopping. The trailers are unbelievable for this. Here's a little montage.
Ever since I was born, I was dope.
Watch out! Watch out!
It's kind of.
I've got it on, and I'm getting more.
LaVie's hologram! So expensive!
Connor currently has 32 people on his personal payroll.
Sure, Connor surrounds himself with people who are agreeable.
This is send up, but also commentary on the way pop music and pop stars work.
It's the Lonely Island movie. Andy Samberg plays Connor for Real, who's this auto-tuned, successful pop singer. And you know, you've seen their SNL videos. I'm on a boat, things like that. This is kind of a collection of those things. Those are the moments that are the funniest. There's a rap song called "Things in My Jeep." There's a song that sort of a ballad that compares lovemaking to the assassination of Osama bin Laden. Kind of inane, weird things like that that are funny. It's not the Spinal Tap that it wants to be, and it's not as pointed a satire as it wants to be, I think because they kind of suffer from Jimmy Fallon syndrome. They've got all the celebrities are in there in the movie, Carrie Underwood, Ringo Starr, Questlove, Nas. They're all part of the joke, and so they don't really skewer anyone or really kind of stick it to anybody in a way that I kind of wish they would. But it's funny, and it has its moments.
It's like hanging out in a very crowded limousine.
It is a little bit like that. And the stars don't say anything that funny. They're just there to kind of show how cool they are and that they're willing to be good sports about it all.
And now the main event, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows.
Dude?
What?
He jumped!
All right, one for all.
But wait, you don't have a shoot!
I don't need a shoot. I got my board!
Delightful or parent killer?
You know, I never know how to review these movies because everything that I would normally consider a negative in a film, like the ugly looking characters and the loudness and sort of the overall irritatingness of it, seem to be exactly the kind of things that people want from it. So I guess I'd say this movie delivers.
Going to be a big, big hit. Rafer Guzman, have a great weekend.
Thanks, John.
Rafer Guzman is the film critic for Newsday. We love you on Fridays.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Each week, Rafer Guzman stops by and gives us his thumbnail assessment of the movie releases of the weekend. But this veteran critic of movies and pop music is also a film scholar. And we thought we'd give you a sense of his depth by sitting him down with one of his colleagues, Aisha Harris, a staff writer and culture critic for Slate. Harris is working on a tribute to the 50 greatest films by black directors, familiar names like Spike Lee and Gordon Parks, but also some groundbreaking films that are almost lost to film history, like the 1941 film The Blood of Jesus, directed by Spencer Williams. Our deep dive now with Rafer Guzman and Slate's Aisha Harris.
Spencer Williams, if he's at all known today, he's known for Amos and Andy. He played one of the lead roles in that show. Amos and Andy is famously a radio show and TV show that people look back on as a very stereotypical, yes, stereotypical show. But he was also a really accomplished filmmaker at a time where there were very few black filmmakers. And so he made a bunch of what they called race films. And The Blood of Jesus is a really historical sort of film.
Good news, Dad, coming in the door to leave me behind.
This is a film with overt Christian symbolism. It's what I think today we would call corny. But why does this film have such a strong critical following?
The fact that it was made at this time in the 40s when there was so few outlets for black people to create, I think that's part of the reason why it has such a following. And it does have some sort of interesting elements cinematically as well.
Okay, let's switch gears completely and talk about Car Wash from 1976. Now, I remember this being a fairly goofy and slightly gritty film with a great soundtrack, one of the best theme songs from the 70s. Why is this film on your list?
Well, you know, we weren't going to consider it. I went and I watched it for the first time, and you may remember the soundtrack, and you may remember the funny parts, and there are a lot of funny parts, but like, it also has a hefty message with it, and it tells this very interesting story, just all these different colorful characters who are trying to just survive, and it all takes place in the space of a day, so it feels very sort of Robert Altman-esque. It has that sort of feel, and I just think it's a really well-done movie, and if you go back and rewatch it in modern days, it still very much holds up.
Okay, speaking of comedies from the 70s, I'm going to ask you a question. Three movies that are not on your list: Uptown Saturday Night, Piece of the Action, Let's Do It Again, directed and starring Sidney Poitier, and also starring, wait for it, Bill Cosby. Is he the reason these films are not on your list?
No. Bill Cosby's not the reason. I've only seen Uptown Saturday Night of the films that Sidney Poitier has directed.
It's the best one.
Yeah. And actually, no, I've seen Let's Do It Again, too. But I don't really think Uptown Saturday Night is that good of a movie.
Wow.
And it really, it's kind of sad that this list doesn't have any Sidney Poitier. It has
right.
no Harry Belafonte. But
right.
like, they rarely worked with black directors.
Uh-huh.
And Sidney himself, I love him. He's a national treasure. But we did not seriously consider Uptown
Saturday Night. Better as an actor than a director, you say?
Yes.
Okay. So let's move on to the obvious name, Spike Lee, who I think has six films
yes.
on this list. Okay. Do the Right Thing from 1989. I remember seeing this film when it came out, and I'm not sure I'd ever seen anything so powerful. And it was a movie that just forced me to look at this issue of race in America from a million different angles. And Spike Lee's dialogue is still just incredible.
Who told you to walk on my side of the block? Who told you to be in my neighborhood?
I own this brownstone.
Who told you to buy a brownstone on my block, in my neighborhood, on my side of the street?
Is it a stretch to say that Spike Lee kind of invented the idea of the black director, what a black director can and should do with his movies?
I don't know if I'd go that far, because when you look at Spike Lee, he's taking from so many different influences of people who came before him, Haile Gerima, Charles Burnett, Gordon Parks.
Yep.
So I think he's just come to, for most people, define what black cinema is. Look, he's by far the most represented person on this list. Part of that is because we think that he's made some really excellent movies. And it's also just the fact that, unlike so many of the filmmakers on this list, he's been really prolific. There's a lot of directors here who have had one or two, and speaks to the nature of just how difficult it is to be a black filmmaker in Hollywood, and even outside of Hollywood, independently.
There's another very prolific black filmmaker that's not on this list, and that is Tyler Perry. He single-handedly employs more black actors than almost anyone in Hollywood that I can think of. Why no love for Tyler Perry?
We've gotten a lot of responses about this piece, about who we've left off.
Of course.
Know. Tyler Perry is not a name that anyone has ever mentioned.
Is like, that right?
Look, he's a populist director, and he brings in people to watch his movies and his TV shows. But I don't think there's anyone who's serious about film or who even is like a casual viewer of film who would consider those movies actually great.
Ouch. Okay, last movie is Creed. And this movie was part of the big controversy at the Oscars because the white supporting actor, Sylvester Stallone, got a nomination, whereas the lead black actor, Michael Jordan, did not. But is this movie really good enough to make your list?
Definitely. What makes Creed so great is in part the fact that, A, he resurrected a franchise that no one... First of all, I don't think too many people wanted it to be resurrected. And then I don't think too many people actually thought it could be. And so he was able to do this and bring a whole new life and perspective to it. And also, it's a film by a black director starring a black main character. But it's not about the struggle of blackness. It is a movie that is universal in a way, even though it's very specific in its terms of location and its use of the biker culture in Philadelphia. So it has all of these really great flourishes, and I think it's going to stand the test of time.
Aisha Harris, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Newsday's Rafer Guzman speaking with Aisha Harris of Slate. To see Aisha's complete list of the best films by black directors, head over to thetakeaway.org. Basketball is about dunks and fast breaks. It's also about lock in. 5.4 million people receive that message before every Golden State Warriors game from Stephen Curry 30. Yes, I mean that, Stephen Curry 30. And they received that message last night. The tweet handle of Curry is just one bit of Twitter theater. Groundbreaking night for the Warriors, says the NBA Twitter account, which also delivers the screen candy of a Vine video of Steph Curry taking out a Cavaliers guard, animation of the ground breaking like an earthquake underneath him, and then Steph makes a three-pointer. That's a lot more fun to watch than the monosyllabic utterings of players.
Just got to keep playing and remain calm and go forward from there.
They're a very battle-tested team, showed a lot of perseverance.
Continue this journey.
And everything's on the line.
On social media, 66 million people got pinged, poked, or received notifications during Game 1 of the NBA Finals. Oh, by the way, the Golden State Warriors beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. You probably knew this. One detail, here's another. The NBA is the third largest American professional sports league in terms of revenue behind the NFL and Major League Baseball, but it has twice as many followers as the NFL. Baseball has 15 million followers. The NHL has just 11 million. Basketball's social presence is international. This winter, the league claimed that it had over 1 billion followers across league, team, and player accounts in the U.S. and China. It's like basketball is some kind of social media platform all by itself. Fans, players, and sponsors trying to reach each other with tweet after tweet after Vine after Vine. Jason Concepcion is a tweetmeister. 103,000 Twitter followers he has. He's an NBA superfan and a writer for the new sports and culture site, The Ringer. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What would you be without Twitter?
I'm not sure. Let's not explore it too deeply.
No, but the combination of the NBA, fandom,
yes,
and Twitter,
yeah,
is something new to the world.
Sure. I think something about the culture of the game lends itself to this kind of trash-talking, personality-driven medium that social media obviously is.
You can't hit a mid-court three-pointer, right?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Since no one's seeing this, yes, I can. Sure.
No, you can't, Jason. But you can tweet just like LeBron.
Yes. Sure.
Or anyone else.
Yeah. I think the fact that Twitter is this kind of leveling force, it gives people the ability to be courtside, to comment directly on the game, to talk directly to the players, is a powerful force. Beyond sports, but obviously in the NBA as well.
It's like you're Spike Lee courtside at the Knicks game. It's like you're on the court being able to yell something in the middle of a game because it's that fast-paced.
Yes. I mean, that's what I was going for when I first started tweeting at basketball games, was to just try and capture that vibe when you're at the park or you're in a small high school gym and people are just talking to the players. You can hear the players speak to each other and capture that vibe.
When have you nailed it? Give me a couple of points where you've nailed it in the course of a season.
The very first tweet that I thought, oh, that one was pretty good, was during the 2009-ish playoffs. The running joke at the time was that Doug Collins, a commentator, was very fond of LeBron, perhaps overly so.
Right.
So I made a joke in that vein. I think that was the first time that I thought, oh, you know, like, okay, this is how you kind of use this.
Who are some of your favorite tweeters?
Oh, man.
In the NBA space, and they don't have to be players. They could be players and fans.
Oh, man. I would say Zach Lowe, I think, is great if you want really smart commentary. Nate Duncan is another guy if you really want that intelligent commentary. Shea Serrano is a hilarious person who is a writer. I would promote The Ringer and say, like, people that are affiliated with the NBA at The Ringer are great follows. Let's see, Matthew Dellavedova. It's like quietly a very good social media presence, not necessarily on Twitter, but otherwise. Tristan Thompson also.
What about stars trying to intimidate their opponents using Twitter and then maybe carrying it out on the
That's part of what makes the medium really great is it gives you entree into these kind of things that you wouldn't hear unless you're sitting courtside. I think one of my favorite things that ever happened on Twitter was Dion Waiters, who now plays for the Oklahoma City Thunder, was at the time playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers. He was getting a lot of criticism about his style of play, and he tweeted a highlight reel of himself from like a season previous, and he said, you know, men lie, buckets don't. DNT, all caps, is just one of the great moments of social media.
What makes the NBA more sort of digitally savvy than the rest of the world?
Well, I think it skews younger, for one. That mm-hmm. certainly helps. So there's a lot of digital natives there. The NBA has always been more personality-driven than the other sports by the simple fact that there's less players on the court and more chance for an individual player to affect the outcome of a game. The NBA has always marketed itself that way as a star-driven league. It's just fun to play with the image of stars. And obviously the players are using social media as a way to increase their brand.
It's as though visually the game lends itself to quick videos, quick, you know, vines, these sorts of things. And the other sports don't. I mean, they're just too slow.
Well, it's a fast free. It certainly is a faster, more free flowing sport. Not as free flowing as soccer, obviously. But you know, you've got it's end to end. You've got one on one interactions all over the court. And unlike football, where you've got lots of one on one interactions, you can see them because there's less players on the court. Baseball is obviously a lot of stop starts, and this is part of what the NBA is trying to leverage with in terms of increasing their global popularity. You know, this flowing, freestyling sort of game.
Does social media predict this series? Is there a way of saying in the social media world, the Warriors or the Warriors fans or the Cavaliers fans are expressing themselves better or worse?
Well, I think, listen, the Warriors are one of the most electric bandwagon teams of recent memory. They play an attractive style. Furthermore, the narrative around the club is one of this kind of Silicon Valley disruption. They take more threes than anyone. You know, Steph Curry is changing the game. They're changing the game in the way they play. Small ball has revolutionized the game. So there's this, when you get on that bandwagon, you get that feeling of, hey, you know, that kind of Silicon Valley utopianism. I'm changing the world. I'm improving basketball by liking this team. If they play the way they've played for most of the season, I think they win the series probably in 5 or 6.
LeBron personally has used social media very successfully, but he's no match for the Warriors' footprint at this point.
Yeah, the Warriors are a global team at this point. There's people that didn't like basketball before that love the Warriors.
So you could go to the middle of Mongolia.
People love Steph Curry. Something I've never seen before, which is player warm-ups. You've got fans and kids swarming Steph Curry's player warm-ups as he does a kind of two-handed dribbling routine, then he takes shots from the tunnel, the player exit tunnel, and people tweet these things and go and watch this. This is something people have not seen before because he really is the way he plays evokes this kind of childlike joy that is translates across nations.
Jason Concepcion, writer for The Ringer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's something to take with you today. Don't want to diminish your childlike joy, but you can trash talk if you want. If you get out of hand in your social media posts, you could get arrested in London. Online crimes of speech are landing a growing number of people in London's courts. According to data reported by the city's police force in response to a Freedom of Information request, cops will get you if you make obscene, anxiety-causing, offensive messages. Are there any other kind? 37% up since 2010. The most common type of these arrests is for sending messages intended to offend or menace. Let's be polite this weekend, whether we're in London or not. Have a great weekend, folks. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.